From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Susan Orlean is my guest. Her latest book is the remarkable bestseller, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. It's a film book, a dog book, a history book, a war book. It's a great book. Susan Orlean is also the author of The Orchid Thief and other books, and is a writer for The New Yorker. Susan Orlean, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Do you have a dog?
I definitely have a dog who is sitting here and staring at me as we speak.
Well, put him on.
Okay. She's quite articulate, actually.
Yeah.
She's not a German Shepherd, I should say, but she's a great dog.
What kind of dog?
I have a Welsh Springer Spaniel.
Have dogs always been part of your life?
I've had dogs. Actually, my first dog was sort of late in life. I was 13 before my family got a dog. But then I got my own dog when I was in college, a very foolhardy, impulsive decision that I always, whenever I tell people about it, I add the note that I think it's a crazy thing to have done. But I wanted a dog so badly, I just couldn't resist. I had her for 13 years. Then I took a little break and got a dog who unfortunately died last summer when he was 9, and I got another dog immediately after he had passed away. So it's been pretty continuous.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the themes in your book that, you know, I mean, it would be great if Galapagos tortoises made great pets or animals that didn't have such a short life, but dogs, they have a short life.
It's an incredible irony given how attached we are to them. And it seems, as far as I can tell, dogs' lifespan has not changed a whole lot in the many years that they've been our closest companions. They seem to live between 10 and 13 years, which means that you go through the cycle of life and death with them, and I suppose that's part of what brings us so close to them in a way, that we really do see their whole life unfold and all of the wonder but also the great poignancy that comes with that.
Well, when I lost my previous dog, not the dog I have now, but she's 13 when she died. And I was, you know, as grief-stricken as I could possibly be. And people, they said, oh, that's too bad about your dog. And then they move along. Whereas if, you know, if you had a child that died at 13, people would go, oh, my God, that's terrible. But for me, it was just as horrible a loss. I can't imagine a loss any worse.
The way it affects you until you've gone through it, from a distance, even if you like dogs, You feel a kind of impatience. Why do people make such a big deal about their dog, especially because you know going into it that a dog is not going to live your whole life with you. And yet it is devastating. The first time I had a dog die, who was my own dog, I felt that the people who didn't understand how upsetting it was, our friendship changed from that point. I felt like it was such a significant passage for me, and I was so genuinely grief-stricken that I could not understand the people who didn't understand how important it was. I think that bond and the way dogs are so deeply intimate in our lives is a lot of what made writing the book so interesting. It wasn't just an animal. It was the animal that, of all of the animals that we've domesticated, these are the ones who we've developed this very unique, very emotional connection to. I think that's why someone said to me, how come there weren't a lot of movies starring cats? And you know, I happen to love cats, and I have 3 cats, but we don't have the same relationship with them. They simply are not as connected to people as dogs are.
Well, also, I mean, an exciting movie, you know, with my cat basically lies on the bed and sucks her toe for 99.9% of her life.
Mm-hmm.
That would not make, you know, a thrilling film necessarily.
Right. And dogs, because dogs have, from the very beginning, served people and, you know, seem to get great joy out of doing something for people, their interaction with us is really extraordinary. Seeing a dog, for instance, a search and rescue dog or a seeing eye dog or a dog with a handler in the military, you're really reminded of the extraordinary connection we have that's led dogs to work for us and to be trusted in ways that, as much as I love my cat, I don't think I would tie a harness to my cat and let him lead me into traffic. I think that would
not be wise.
That would be a kind of leap of faith that I'm not sure any of us would ever want to make.
No. Cats make good cartoons.
Yes.
In fact, around the same time as Rin Tin Tin, there was the first cat cartoon. It was Felix the Cat. I think he was around 1919 or something like that.
And it's funny because there were a lot of cats in cartoons and
yeah.
Tom and Jerry and on and on. But they didn't appear that frequently with people. I think for that very reason that they're not they don't connect with us in the same way. I mean, it's been proven evolutionarily that dogs actually did develop specifically to have a connection with people that is far deeper than even that of primates. They're not as close to us genetically as a chimpanzee is, but they have a far better capacity for mirroring human emotion, for relating to people in a personal way. And that says a lot. You know, they're not the same DNA as we are, but they emotionally are somehow tuned in far better than our closer relatives.
Well, and of course, the connection with dogs is you know, a key aspect of your story. But as I was saying in the introduction, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, it's such a wide scope in this book. How did you conceive of the book? What were the stories you wanted to tell?
I had come across Rin Tin Tin's name without any expectation. It was kind of came up out of the blue as I was working on another New Yorker story, and I hadn't thought about Rin Tin Tin in many decades. You know, he was the love of my life when I was a very young kid, but of course I hadn't thought about him in a long time. His name popped up during some other reporting. I had such an emotional reaction to it that I was really struck by that. Just that alone surprised me, that I literally sat up straight in my chair and said, "Oh my God, Rin Tin Tin." Well, then, doing a little bit of noodling around, as one does when one is trying to look productive but actually isn't being productive, I came across what I found to be astonishing, and that was the simple fact that this television character, who I had believed to be nothing more than a TV character, had been a real dog, had been born not in the 1950s when he was a TV star, but in 1918 in World War I on a battlefield, and that he had been found by an American GI who brought him back as a pet and then decided to try to get him into movies. And subsequently, he became probably one of the very most popular, most recognized stars in the 20s. And in silent film, he was globally recognized. His fame accounts for Warner Brothers being a major studio because he was such a big star. And the story of the idea that something has lasted for so long through so many changes in culture and was loved by so many people who were drawn to the same iconic character, that to me was fascinating. And as it turned out, the character of Rin Tin Tin has a real Zelig-like quality that surprised me over and over again. Every period of time, every form of pop culture that I assumed he had no part in, there he was again. And the story was actually much richer than I could have ever dreamed of. And then what made it really appealing to me as a writer was the fact that the people who were involved in the story, Lee Duncan, the young man who found the dog in the war, Burt Leonard, who became the producer of the TV show and who became as devoted and committed to the idea of Rin Tin Tin as Lee did, they had amazing life stories that were almost unbelievable. They were so varied and complicated and had such huge turns of fortune that they were remarkable stories.
We're talking with Susan Orlean, and her new book is called Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. Well, Rin Tin Tin, and you were pointing out in your book, as you were just saying, that he's an actor. That is, you were talking about contrasting him with Lassie, that Lassie is a fictional character who was portrayed by a dog, but Rin Tin Tin is a dog who portrayed other dogs in the movies.
Exactly. It's funny. It's one of those things that you just said very succinctly and clearly that I've struggled to explain to people because they actually are in our worlds for entirely different reasons. It's almost as if they are mirror opposites. You know, one began with real life and became a representation in pop culture. The other was the representation who was then played by real dogs. So they're entirely opposite stories.
And there was, like, you were listing them in the book, there's like tons of dog stars in the 20s whose films, I suppose, have all decomposed, sadly. But, I mean, there was Tarzan and Black Thunder and Grace. I can't remember them.
Right. I mean, they're just, the list is amazing. You know, Thunderheart and Strongheart and Lightning and Lightning Bolt. And there were about 80 other German Shepherds making films in the 1920s because of the fact that most silent film has deteriorated or been lost or was destroyed, specifically destroyed. We really have no record of most of them. And most of them didn't achieve any of the fame that Rin Tin Tin did. They may have had a fan club and made some movies, but Rin Tin Tin was far and away the biggest star of a genre that was huge. Funny to even think about it now, since most of the films are forgotten, but it was a huge piece of Hollywood in the 1920s, these films starring German Shepherds.
And not intended necessarily for children, that is, children could certainly see them and enjoy them, but they were intended for adults to watch.
And that amazed me. They were definitely, you know, plenty of kids went, but they were made as action films. Some of the subject matter was fairly adult, and there were almost no children in them. In fact, there is an occasional young person, but by and large, the characters were all adults.
And Rin Tin Tin and his compatriots, they weren't dogs that slept on the foot of the bed. They were outdoor dogs.
They had a different role. And dogs were viewed in culture differently in the 1920s than they are now. I mean, now, if you had a dog who you didn't allow in your house and you kept out in a doghouse, people would probably think you were kind of cruel. In the 20s, most Americans still were living in rural settings. They had dogs, but dogs lived outside. They had not developed into the indoor companions that they became later in the century. The dogs in those films in the 1920s also had a different role. They were independent sort of characters. They were on par with the people in the film, and it wasn't that they were the companion of the leading man. They were significant characters in the film, and they were not doggy. They were not pets. They acted on with their own motivation and their own. They had their own world, and the stories often were about how their worlds collided with the world of the of people. So it was a very different role from, say, in the 30s and 40s, where dogs were in film a lot, but they were more often the adorable companion to the main actors in the film.
Do you think the advent of animated features changed people's attitudes about dog movies? Because, you know, Lady and the Tramp, or that is, you know, you could see dogs in a different way because of animated cartoons, which didn't exist in the days of Rin Tin Tin.
Right. Well, I think that there were so many changes. For one thing, even before the advent of animated film being so popular, what really changed the role of dogs in certainly in film and in its own way in popular culture was the talkies. You know, in silent film, nobody spoke. Dogs never speak, but they seem in a silent film perfectly natural, not speaking. People, on the other hand, look kind of diminished in a silent film. Their mouths flap around and no noise comes out, and they're actually at a disadvantage, whereas a dog is in its element, using action and gesture and expression to convey their story. In the case of the talkies, suddenly the big difference between people and dogs was underscored and exaggerated. People could talk, dogs couldn't. People came flocking to the movies to hear people talk. So there was suddenly dogs who had dominated in the 20s and been so popular and so beloved, suddenly dogs were kind of awkward in those films, and their stock fell dramatically. Rin Tin Tin had his contract canceled by Warner Brothers, even though he had been such a big star. His films were still making all sorts of money for Warner Brothers, but as a company, Warner Brothers had decided that they wanted to focus on the talkies, and they just couldn't imagine that a dog would have a role in talkies. And they couldn't imagine the dog would have a role anything like the role they had in the films of the 20s. That was heroic. They were the ones who were going to solve whatever travails were appearing on the horizon, and they did it with, you know, silently. When films suddenly introduced talking, well, the dog just seemed like he couldn't talk, and I think there was such a change. Such
Except for
dramatic
that one dog
change.
You talked about, that one dog you talked about that can say "Mama, Papa," and "Hamburger."
Right, exactly. Well, there were these films that became really popular, and they're bizarre, and I became a little obsessed with them for a while.
You can get them, the Dogville.
The Dogville shorts, yeah. And you can get them, and
but don't bother.
they are so weird. Basically, the producers took popular Hollywood films and then remade them with casts of just dogs and an occasional cat, and they were manipulated so it looked like they were talking.
It's like a live action version of those dogs playing poker.
It's exactly like that, where the subject is you know, they made, one of the popular ones was called Dogway Melody, that was just basically Broadway Melody recast with dogs, and they are
actually
so
preferable to the original Broadway Melody.
Right. They're so weird, and they were very popular as novelties. So, you know, there was definitely, I mean, people certainly didn't lose their interest in dogs. Well, Hollywood simply was swept up in the excitement
of talkies.
And that was where the interest was. Rin Tin Tin ended up making movies during that time for smaller studios, and they were very popular. But they were taken so much less seriously. You know, his dominance of Hollywood really changed, and it was nothing compared to what he had experienced in the 20s.
Well, Susan Orlean, talk a little bit about the, when you're talking about the, and I like the way you describe the population drawn to cities like metal filings to a magnet, but about how animals, the role of animals in their lives became a nostalgic thing because it translated from working animals to something else.
I found this one of the most moving and fascinating parts of the book for me, and one that continues to fascinate me. This idea that a lot of philosophers have surmised and suggested that once we became urban people, animals, which had had a role in, you know, agrarian society that was so fundamental and so significant and everyday, suddenly their role receded. Now, obviously, they didn't recede in the sense that we were eating animals and using wool, and we were still making every bit of use of them, but the average person was no longer living on a farm. Animals, which had been utilitarian and accepted in one particular way, suddenly became a symbolic connection to that former life. And there are some people who would say, oh, we're making too much of it, but there's the idea that the notion of modernness began at that moment when people's connection to the natural world became secondary. More and more people were living in cities, working in factories, not connected to the land anymore, and not connected to animals primarily. And it was an entirely new universe. And I really think there's no question that the world became very different at that point, and in some ways sadder, and the idea, as I suggested, that it used to be that animals lived in close quarters and did work that was monotonous, and suddenly people were living in packed cities, working in factories, and they were living a life that almost resembled the life of animals in some cases. So I do think that there's something important about that change in society that's very significant. And we began, to some extent, fetishizing animals as pets, as surrogate children. You know, you would never see someone living on a farm dressing their dog in fancy clothing. I mean, that's a phenomenon that simply wouldn't exist.
No.
In a place where animals had a utilitarian role.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, too, because when we think about Rin Tin Tin and the movies, and the movies that you described, and you describe him as being a really good actor. And I think about when I was a kid watching Rin Tin Tin on television like you did, and I also watched, you know, My Friend Flicka and Fury and Flipper. And one of the thing that really annoyed me about Flipper, for instance, was that Flipper was never in it. You know, Flipper was on at the beginning, And then the adventures of the kids, and then Flipper would come back at the end to remind you that it was a Flipper show.
Right.
But in the Rin Tin Tin movies, you know, Rin Tin Tin was in every scene.
He was. He was the leading man. He was the draw. He was the name above the name of the film. And animals became accessories in that next iteration. They were, people still loved seeing them and loved their appearance in film and TV, but in the 20s, you know, it's funny when you see those movies, because you don't quite believe this until you see it, you know, on the screen. The dog is a real character, and he has a struggle and a journey in the films, and so do the humans. But when you get to The Adventures of Rin Tin Tin, the television show, the adventure and the journey is all the humans doing, and the dog is there as their companion and associate, but he doesn't really go through anything. He's just there as a, you know, a beautiful, inspiring figure who will intervene and save the day, but he doesn't make anything happen in his own world. So it is a very different role, and I'm not sure that I think it's been a very long time since we saw animals in a film go through some sort of emotional change the way Rin Tin Tin did in those movies in the 20s.
Well, you know, I think nowadays, because they can do anything in a movie, you know, Babe or whatever, they can make animals do whatever they want and make it look very realistic. But the amazing thing about movies in the teens and 20s is that everything you saw on the screen is actually happening.
It's incredible. And when you watch Rin Tin Tin leap and run and climb trees, and you realize that it was all real, that this was not CGI, this wasn't special effects, it's thrilling. I've shown Clash of the Wolves, which is my favorite of the Rin Tin Tin films that still exist. I've showed it to a lot of audiences, and I'm fascinated to hear people gasping in amazement as they're watching Rin Tin Tin perform his athletic feats. And these are people who have seen just about everything happen on film, and you know, you're almost jaded imagining, okay, a dog jumps over a chasm. Big deal. But it is a big deal when you know it's real. And the fact is, we are limited, you know, in our earthly bodies, and seeing a dog fly over a chasm, and you know he's really doing it, it is thrilling. It's much more like theater in that sense, that you know what you're seeing is real, and you don't have the detachment that technology has created in film, where you look at it and part of you is thinking, interesting, I wonder how they did that in the, you know, how the computer was programmed to make it look that way.
Right.
You know, you don't, it's rare that you see something happening in a movie now and you're amazed by what's happening. You can't believe it's happening, because we've just become too familiar with the fact that most of this is being done in post-production, and nobody was really doing something that was really, really dangerous or exciting or amazing.
Well, we've only just kind of scratched the surface of your book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend, so I think everybody listening should join the millions of people who've already read it and read it, because it's a great book. And Susan Orlean, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. Can you come back sometime soon and talk some more?
I'd love to. I really appreciate it, and I'd be happy to. I guess one of the wonderful things about the book is there are so many things to talk about, and it would be wonderful to pick up and continue.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. I want to thank our guest, Susan Orlean, and her book is called Rin Tin Tin, The Life and the Legend. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Bye-bye.